Welcome to The Reaction Podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin. A podcast where we talk about politics, geopolitics, culture, economics. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, go to the website, www.reaction.life, and you get my weekly newsletter on all sorts of things. Now, I'm joined this week by my friend and colleague, Tim Montgomery. We haven't spoken for a few weeks on this podcast, Tim, and there's really only one subject we can kick off with. I mean, there's a lot happening in the world, but let's focus on UK politics to begin with. The condition of the Conservative Party. Now, we joked before we started recording this podcast, we joked that we always seem to be talking about how dire the situation is, and usually the Conservative Party does something to rescue itself, whether that be in 2019 or 2015 when it won an overall majority under David Cameron. But this time it looks really serious, looking at the poll gap between Labour and the Conservatives. We'll come to Reform in a moment. How bad is it, do you think?
As bad as almost it could be, I think, Ian. If there are Conservatives tuning in now and they do not want to be depressed, they probably should switch off now, because I don't know whether you've got any good news for them, but I certainly don't. You think about it, really, we haven't spoken for a few weeks, but I think the last time we did speak was, you know, before a number of things have been done by the Conservative Party to try and get back on, you know, some sort of path to a sensible result. I don't think any of us think the Conservative Party can avoid defeat at the next election, but there's been this hope that they would minimise the loss. And so, you know, we've had a cabinet reshuffle, very significant cabinet reshuffle, bringing back David Cameron from the political dead. We've had a very significant party conference where big announcements, positive changes in my view, were made on things like HS2 and net zero, sensible housekeeping. We've had a big AI summit, which was part of a general strategy to show that Rishi Sunak was in charge of, you know, the future. He knew he knew what was coming. He was a modern prime minister. We're recording in the aftermath. Aftermath is probably the wrong word, but maybe is the right word, of an autumn statement where big tax cuts were announced, which has been pretty universally seen as less than the full truth of what the party's doing. Reset after reset has taken place, could mention others, and yet the Tory opinion poll rating is either flat or falling. The immigration numbers have just come out, which are an extraordinary failure of politics and government by the Conservative Party. And I am beginning to think, I have thought for a little while now, the longer the party stays in power, the worse the result will be, because they aren't changing the weather, they aren't impressing people, and I think the reaction to from voters is going to be very negative.
So you're thinking in terms of...
And I'm sorry again to all Conservative listeners for all that.
Yes, to any remaining Conservatives out there, it looks like a pretty grim picture as described by Tim. Shall I begin with something upbeat then?
Yeah, I'd like to hear it myself.
To slightly counter that from from the perspective of a party that's been 13 years in power, they can look at, for example, the Autumn Statement, I think. The Autumn Statement had, I would say, some pretty good stuff in it, actually, in terms of the growth measures, the supply side reforms, full expensing. I know there's a debate about that, but I think that's a pro-growth measure that's designed to encourage business investment. I thought Jeremy Hunt, when he was describing the tax changes when he was speaking on the radio the morning after, was more measured than CCHQ had been, saying the Tory party cuts taxes. That's what the Tory party does. Well, as he acknowledged, the tax burden is rising. We'll come to that in a moment, why that's the case. The tax burden is rising. But he took an opportunity there to essentially slow that trend and to start to take things in the other direction. But the tax burden is rising, and there'll be some people listening to this screaming at the radio or whatever device they're listening to this on, saying, "What are you talking about? Taxes are going through the roof." Well, the reality is Britain spent far more than it should have done on COVID, plus then an enormous energy package, which was prompted by the outbreak of the first war in Europe since the breakup of Yugoslavia. And The cost, combined cost of that is, depending on how you measure it, somewhere between $400 billion and $500 billion that the country didn't, at the beginning of the decade, expect to have to find. So I think, in the circumstances, I'm not. I agree with you. I think they're in real trouble. But just a slightly more upbeat note there on the package. I thought the growth stuff and the pro-business stuff was commendable. Mm. And also the contrast with a year ago, or a bit more than a year ago, when Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss had their go with their mini budget in the autumn of last year. The contrast is very stark. Mm. And
Better than Liz Truss, though, isn't much of a... and I agree with everything you just said, Ian, but... And, you know, the HS2 announcement, I think, was brave and necessary. I don't think Labour will revive HS2. It was a project way out of control, and it was brave to cancel it. The tidying up on net zero, still being committed to hitting net zero, but achieving it on a more realistic timescale, whether it's, you know, gas boilers or, you know, cars, etc. But the electoral side... None of this is making any difference. Even when they do good things, and overall I agree, the autumn statement was finally turning the tide on a rising tax burden. But yeah, the tax burden is still rising. Yeah. All those things are good, but the electoral impact of all these things seems to be non-existent. People have stopped listening. And for good reason. You know, I will vote Conservative at the next election because my local MP, John Glenn, is a good MP. But overall, taxes have risen. And, you know, you gave an explanation as to why. Home ownership is down. Immigration is up. Public services are unreformed. Wokery has taken control of Whitehall. Subject you know a lot about. The military is not in good shape. You know, all the sort of things people thought the Conservative Party existed for have gone in the wrong direction in recent years. And I don't want a Labour government, but in any way of laws of political justice, the Conservative Party does deserve to be punished.
Pretty difficult to win after what you described there. Yeah, I think we agree on the scale potentially of what's coming. And while I can say, well, look, I think Sunak's done some quite good stuff in the last few months. I do think a lot of conference was mishandled, but the AI summit I think was an important initiative, and was a success. I do think Hunt over Kwarteng or any of the alternatives I think is doing some quite sensible stuff. I think, and a lot of people may disagree, I think bringing back David Cameron is a good and sensible move. We burn through our politicians far too quickly, and it we should go back to the older approach of people having longer careers or returning to office with a bit of wisdom. But okay, so that's the upside for me. The downside on the electoral side of the ledger, as you put it, is potentially catastrophic for them. I think there are two things happening in tandem which make this as dangerous a moment as pre-97, though arguably worse. And the first is the conventional thing. It's easy to see. Labour are around 20 points ahead. Depends whose polling you look at. But they're running roughly on the poll of polls average, somewhat 20-plus points ahead. So that's the first thing. And that's just on the back of Labour has got its act together quite impressively in certain respects, and the Tories have been in power for the last 13 years, and you can't lay on the kind of circus that the Conservative Party has laid on since 2016 and then expect people to say thank you. And then all the cost of living stuff as well, just that thing we've talked about before, just people saying, you're tired, please get off my television set, go away for a while.
Sorry to interrupt you. I'm just having a message from the National Association of Circus representatives, and they're objecting to your comparison of the recent events to circus, because they say that's actually quite a lot of skill in circuses.
Yeah, and, and they're going to sue.
Yes.
So, you know, it's not just that. It's the country looking at them saying, you're tired, please get off our television sets and just go away for a few years, which is normal in a democracy. I mean, you cannot have a situation in which the same party wins forever. That's fine. That's bad enough. But the thing that is starting to trouble some Conservatives and some Tory MPs I've spoken to. Some are less worried about it, but the thing that you can feel, this fear you can feel spreading through the Tory tribe, is related not to the party that's above them, but the party that's down at the bottom in the polling, or around the same as the Liberal Democrats, which is Reform, which is the party which is, its patron saint is Nigel Farage, who's in the jungle. We'll talk about him more in a moment. He's starring in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, but it's run by Richard Tice, his friend. Now, Reform has started to poll about 10% in the polls, and I think the ingredients are there for something catastrophic to happen for the Conservative Party, which is that Farage, emerging from the jungle, and I've been watching it this week, I think it's sort of that show is fascinating this year. It's where the real political action is. And Farage, remember, as various people have pointed out, doesn't yet know that David Cameron has been appointed as Foreign Secretary. He will learn all this when he comes out. And there is about 10% of the electorate, maybe higher, maybe 15%, maybe even a little bit higher than that, that is waiting to be activated by a Farage Reform Brexit Party style campaign, which is aimed at legal immigration, illegal migration, and a general sense that of powerlessness post-Brexit, that people feel, I think we can discuss whether they're right or wrong, but they feel a sense of powerlessness about their government and their ability to influence these things, or their government's ability to do anything internationally. It's bound by this web of great treaties and international law, and the world is changing very fast. Huge migration flows. Just look at the numbers again this week. They can't influence it. And I think that part of the electorate, which is not going to win an election, this is the key point. That part of the electorate, if it is well organised and motivated by Farage, can take sufficient votes off the Conservatives and sometimes Labour, but it matters less for Labour because they're miles in front, and can cost the Conservative seats. Now, there are pollsters who argue about whether that's 50 seats or 100 seats, but it's a significant number of seats potentially if Reform get their act together and run. And that is the difference between defeat, normal style defeat, and an absolute rout. And the problem the Conservative Party has now is that there isn't a deal that Reform want. Reform, or as they were the Brexit Party in 2019, kind of liked Boris. They didn't like Mrs. May. They forced her out by winning the European elections. Then they got Boris. They wanted a formal deal with Boris, but he wouldn't do that. But they backed away because they knew that that was the chance to get Brexit. He was sworn to get Brexit done, so they stood down a lot of candidates. This time, they are not going to do anything like that. They are absolutely determined, and they have the money and the motivation. And they don't want to deal with the Conservative Party. They want to destroy the Conservative Party.
Mm. And I can't believe that the BBC would help them, though, in that project, would they? The BBC aren't going to give Richard Tice and Nigel Farage endless publicity. That wouldn't happen, would it?
Yeah. Definitely not. Definitely not. You can guarantee that. They won't be on television or Question Time at all in the months ahead.
Now, I don't know whether you're now trying to compete with me for bleakness, but I think you may have won the contest, because that is the real thing that should and does scare the living daylights out of Tory MPs. It's the Nigel Farage. I know he's hated by lots of people, but amongst 15-20% of the electorate, including many Conservatives, he's a hero. And if Conservatives feel, what's the point of voting for Sunak? Nothing's going to happen. A lot of people will vote Farage. And you turn then a defeat into a catastrophe for the Conservative Party. And then, you know, we've discussed and don't propose we revisit it today. We've talked about who leads the Conservative Party after defeat. But you then look at a very different potential personality needed, because there is a different set of skills needed to bring a party back from the dead, to almost start again, which is where the Conservative Party could be if it's down to, say, 120, 150 MPs, and someone who's competitive and needs to defeat an incumbent failing Labour administration. Because the sadness is, we had 18 years of Conservative government, then 13 years of Labour, then 13 years of of Tory-led government. I don't think that necessarily will be the pattern with the next, with the future. There's a volatility in the electorate these days, which means that Labour could easily fail. I don't think Labour are prepared particularly well for office. I think the economy could be quite difficult. I don't think Keir Starmer's been honest with the electorate or his MPs about some of the difficult choices he's going to have to make. I know we shouldn't make a mountain out of it, but I was very amazed about Rachel Reeves and that copy and pasting scandal where, you know, that book appeared where she clearly hadn't got hold of some, you know, a very important thing she was publishing. And, you know, what is her team like? Because she's going to be tested like no other in the future. And yet she made a really rookie error in that. So the sadness is Labour are beatable and the country may need to be rescued from Labour, but the Conservative Party could find itself so far from office and the right so divided, Labour could get two terms almost by accident.
That's a really good point, though, about the volatility, in that you think back to late 2019 or early 2020, just on the eve of the pandemic, the Tories have won an 80-seat majority. I think they hit 50 points in the polls at one point or another. Boris is set for a decade in power. Remember all of that rubbish, which is, whenever you see that written about politicians or how things are going to be, just think back. And it's, I mean, you could have said it at the sort of high watermark of Harold Macmillan or Tony Blair or Margaret Thatcher, or, and it's just, it never quite works out, like that. It's hubris. And at that point, though, the Labour Party was not in ruins because it still has its superstructure. It still has its, or its infrastructure, the trade unions, CLPs, which actually lots of people were determined not to be driven out of the Labour Party during the disastrous Corbyn era, stayed. And then the party could go from that, offering Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister, to the current situation where it has Keir Starmer, perfectly plausible as Prime Minister, and a fairly centrist social democratic manifesto, and on track for a majority of 200. And that's all within, that's within the space of 4 years.
Yeah.
So you're right, actually, things could, the Conservative Party could be rejuvenated. But what's going to make it difficult, surely, is that that force, the reform force, the Farage force, is probably, if it does well enough to cost the Conservatives lots of seats, it's not going to go away. It's going to, will it then want to take over the Conservative Party?
Very possibly.
Or will it, as some of its main the main people in reform think, this is now all about proportional representation and convincing a future government that you must scrap the first past the post system, and then you could have a permanent reform Brexit-style party at about 20 to 25% of the vote, and you reconfigure British politics that way. But I'm not sure, but that depends on them getting Starmer to deliver them PR, which I think if Keir Starmer wins a majority of 200 by first past the post, there is no way he's going to say, do you know what, I think this is a rather suspect electoral system and we must examine it. He's not going to take the chance. He's going to go for a second term under the same rules, no doubt. So that's a flaw in the reform Brexit Party Farage analysis, that they probably don't end up with PR anyway. Yep. But just on Farage himself, I mean, you know him well, Tim. I've clashed with him a lot. I mean, one of the oddities of the whole Brexit era, or covering Farage and writing about him for so long, is that if you make these observations about the incredible impact that he's had, people automatically assume, and you see it in comments under articles you write or in any kind of form of public debate, people assume that you support him.
I know. I had that.
And I very much don't.
In the last couple of days, just, you know, saying what a moment Geert Wilders leading the polls was in Holland. And people immediately assume that you should support Geert Wilders because you're noting it as a phenomenon.
It's a significant political event, and it's also a disaster considering this. You know, many of the things he said.
Wants to ban the Quran and things like that.
And the speech he gave in Moscow in 2018 was an extraordinary, terrible speech. But you can see, it is quite frustrating. We're so divided now that even noting how extraordinary a political phenomenon is, people just assume that you're doing so approvingly. And with Farage, I've clashed with him many times, and you've disagreed with him many times, but he is arguably the biggest political figure of the age, I would say arguably more significant than Boris. And if historians in 100 years' time are talking about this, they're more likely to talk about the Farage era or the Farage interregnum than they are about Boris Johnson, who seemed, I think, like a bit of a comic character. But Farage was a Eurosceptic and in favour of withdrawal when it was highly unfashionable to be a politician advocating that. There's no doubt that he forced David Cameron into a position where Cameron had to offer a referendum if he wanted to win a general election. So he pressured the Conservative Party. And then in 2019, he effectively removed Theresa May and gave the and created the conditions in which Boris would win. So he's a serious
figure. Let me ask you a question, because I think if Farage led the Conservative Party, I would vote for it still. I'm not sure you would.
Well, I don't vote, as you know. So, I mean, I don't.
I didn't know you didn't vote.
I try not to. I try not to talk about who I vote for if I've ever voted.
So you're going to duck that question?
I'd duck that question, but I make an exception because it's Farage. No, I couldn't.
You couldn't vote for him, no?
No.
What is it in particular that you object to about him?
I like the two-party system, and of course it has the SNP and the Liberal Democrats in it, but for the sake of argument, it's Labour versus Tory, which is how I like my politics. And I think that system is one of the great things about Britain. And it has soaked up a hell of a lot of pressure, or it's been a safety valve, mixing my metaphors. And it means that a party, if it wants to win, needs to be pretty broad-based in British society and fairly ecumenical within its tribe. And Farage is not that.
He's a
brilliant populist campaigner. Some of the poses that he struck during the referendum in the run-up to Brexit, I disagreed with vehemently. The famous poster. And I could not have voted for Brexit. I voted for Brexit, as you did, Tim. I couldn't have voted for it if Farage and his friends had been running the Yes campaign or the No campaign, or whichever side it would be, getting my referendums mixed up.
Yeah, the Leave campaign. Yeah.
The Leave campaign, that's it. So, no, I couldn't. But then I do acknowledge, if he was here now, I mean, he can be very interesting and amusing. Yeah. I acknowledge the incredible role that he's played in shaping British political history in the last quarter of a century. But I think a Conservative Party led by him, or maybe even a Conservative Party led by Suella Braverman, I think a lot of middle ground members would leave, and a lot of middle ground voters would just opt out and say the Conservative Party had gone somewhere that they couldn't go.
Well, certainly a party led by Suella Braverman, I couldn't support one of those. It's one of the things that most annoys me about the right, you know, at the moment, is that Suella Braverman, Liz Truss, they aren't Margaret Thatcher. You know, they're able to say, state positions that the right should support, but they don't have the tactical, substantial, policy smarts, the communication skills of parliamentary management to make any of them real. And whereas one of the, you know, Nigel Farage is definitely, you're right about the ecumenical. I think that's a really interesting insight. That he isn't ecumenical, but he has led a party. He is good at speaking. He's good at television interviews. He's good at policy. You know, he's got a rare combination of skills, which has made him, you know, one of the very few successful populist leaders anywhere in, you know, the Western world in recent times. And neither Suella Braverman or Liz Truss have his skills.
Do you think, I know this is a very difficult question to answer because it depends on the circumstances in which he'd be running for leadership of the Conservative Party. Is it afterwards, when they're on 120 seats, does he try and, with donor money, organise some kind of takeover? Could he win? Could he become leader of the Conservative Party with the Tory Party membership? I mean, you're founder of Conservative Party, of Conservative Home. You know the party inside out. Is it credible? Could it happen?
Well, looking at it now, no. And, of course, one of the interesting aspects that will be different from a rout this time compared to 1997 is in 1997 a lot of the MPs that were left were sort of to the right of the balance of the party. This time, if you look at, you know, who's in the safer Tory seats, particularly in the south, which I think will hold more blue wall seats and red wall seats, for example, they are more sort of centrist, One Nation caucus, and so they are much less likely to welcome Nigel Farage's leader, if, of course, he wins a seat. You know, Reform could do incredibly well in a general election, and yet again, Nigel Farage could fail to win a seat.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting him in a by-election isn't anywhere as easy as some people would suggest. So probably my answer to you is no, he wouldn't, because he'd, even if the membership of the party were in favour of him, the MPs probably wouldn't let him get through to the second round. But, a traumatised Conservative Party, absolutely on its back heel. You know, perhaps if it does fall but to 120 rather than 150 or even lower, well, all bets are off.
Wow. What a thought. What a thought. I mean, it does occur that another thought occurs, which is that the Tories should obviously, and this is Boris Johnson who chose not to, should have sent Farage to the Lords for reasons of political convenience as well as...
It's extraordinary he's never been honoured.
Yeah. I've had a lot of stick about this down the years. Yeah. I mean, various people say you're the person who's in favour of Farage going to the Lords, as though that means I approve of his politics. There are all sorts of people in the Lords whose politics I disagree with. It just seems to me very odd and classically, sort of classic modern Britain, that the person we described earlier who played that enormous political role is not in the House of Lords, but then all sorts of other people are. But still, if they had sent him to the Lords, of course, which is really, I think, ultimately what he wanted to go to the fusion rooms or the tea rooms in the House of Lords, order a gin and tonic and smile and feel that he was part of the British establishment or had been accepted by the British establishment, but they were determined to snub him. And the result is now he's back. He's coming back.
It's a general phenomenon that I don't understand, actually, Ian. I think Matthew Elliott, who led the Vote Leave campaign, is on Liz Truss's list of five peers to be ennobled, and we're still waiting to see what happens to that. But, you know, immediately after the referendum result, David Cameron honoured all the people who sort of led the Remain campaign and lost. Most of the people who led the Leave campaign have still been completely unrecognised. And it's sort of, if you want to sort of to fuel the Leave campaigner people's view that the establishment is against them,
it's
just another example of maybe they're right.
Yeah. It's amazing that Boris would let people down like that. I mean, it's just, you'd never have predicted it, would you? Shocking. Should we talk a little bit about Rishi Sunak and what on earth he can do? I mean, there's an argument for him carrying on really just doing what he's doing, because there isn't some magic policy that he can announce. You can't stop the boats in the next, 6 months or a year.
With conversations I've had with senior members of the government recently, I've just said, I think the best thing you can do is accept that you're going to lose. Of course, this is not necessarily advice they want to hear or they will act on, but you know, I think the election is lost. And, you know, it was in C.S. Lewis, a Christian philosopher who I most admire. He says, you know, if you seek comfort, you probably will find neither comfort nor truth. If you seek truth, you might find truth. And in finding truth, you find comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder, actually, if the Conservative Party concentrated on being a good government for 12 months, not worrying about the electoral implications, but continuing to do the good housekeeping that they've been doing, you know, the cancellation of HS2, the much more sensible timetable for net zero, you know, the sensible global bringing together work you highlighted at the AI summit. Just keep doing that stuff. You know, the change to corporation tax in the autumn statement.
Or to full expensing.
Expensing.
Yeah.
Just carry on doing those things. Be the prime minister this country needs. And you might be surprised that there will be a reward, not a transformation, but an electoral reward when after another 12 months of it, the British people notice it. Mm. But actually, if it is all about, like those Tory HQ tweets, the finest, you know, the biggest tax cut in history and all the rest of it, I don't think that will appeal to the prudent average Conservative voter who feels disillusioned at the moment.
There's something really wrong with the... I agree with all that, though there will be some people, again, listeners here, objecting strongly to that characterization, saying the last thing that they should carry on doing is what they've been doing. They're a disaster. They need to change on absolutely everything. But we, I think we agree that if you, if the pitch is, this is a contradiction, what I don't understand about their communications strategy, and communications does matter. Politics is partly about stories and narratives and telling stories. If the story that they're trying to tell is that Rishi Sunak is a serious person after the carnage of Truss and all of that sort of fantasy cartoon version of Thatcherism, which failed spectacularly last year, it doesn't then make any sense to make your communications glib and childlike and not entirely truthful.
100%. 100%.
So, this is the oddest thing about the net zero business, where actually I don't think they have rowed back enough on that, but that's a whole other argument. I think politics will shift in that direction in the next couple of years anyway, simply because of the financial realities of the West trying to do this at a speed which is not really ready for, and voters will rebel and have started.
One of the reasons why I think a Keir Starmer government will founder.
Yeah, and it may be on that issue. It may be on the issue of industrial competitiveness and the impact that then has on cost of living and prices and all the rest of it. But if the pitch is that you're serious, then why, when he was doing the net zero business, come up with that list of ridiculous non-measures that Labour weren't thinking about introducing, like meat taxes and all that sort of stuff. So I'm stopping the following XYZ. Yeah. So that contradicted the message, as did the piece of communications you're talking about on Twitter or X, on social media, straight after the Autumn Statement, when it would have been far better to say, as Hunt was trying to do the morning after when he did the media round, the tax burden's rising. Let's face it, why that is. That's COVID, which people were screaming for spending at the time. Not everyone was. Some were warning that it was unaffordable, but that particular policy, or the way in which we locked down the economy for too long, plus the war, and the impact of that means that taxes have to rise to pay for it. Now comes the bill. That seems to be a more sensible argument.
Absolutely.
But I don't quite understand. There must be something in number 10 which means that isn't joined up. The main political strategy is at odds with the communication strategy.
I think one of the basic explanations is, when you first enter government, you have all the best people, they're enthusiastic about getting into government. You've had a few years in opposition where, David Cameron was surrounded by people who believed in him and understood him. And over time, the best people have gone off. They've gone into corporate affairs. You've had a number of changes of administration where the personnel have changed. And I just think there is a basic problem at the moment that the quality of the average person in Tory HQ and Downing Street isn't very high. And so,
if you're listening from Tory HQ or from Number 10, I'd like to apologise on Tim's behalf for disassociating myself.
I think I've probably lost most of them already with most of what I said, but there are some exceptions, and we know some of them, just in case they are listening. But overall, and it happened with Labour. By the time Brown took over from Blair, a lot of the good people are gone, and there's just a length of being in power where you lose that edge and you lose that. You lose that understanding of who you're working for and your ability to get stuff done.
We'll talk more another time about the US. But I mean, it's not just the UK election that's coming in 2024. There is an election coming in the United States. What's your perspective on that? I mean, since we last spoke, it looks even more likely that Trump is going to be the candidate, probably less likely that Biden is going to be the candidate. Actually, you just get this swirling sense that the Democrat establishment is working on a way to try and get him to stand down, probably to be replaced with Gavin Newsom. But it looks like it's Trump at the moment, doesn't it?
It does. And I think one of the most interesting things that's happened since we last spoke, and I think it's very significant for the Democrats, is that, Joe Biden flew off to Israel straight after the horrible events of October the 7th, gave a staunch speech in favour of Israel. And a very large section of the Democratic Party increasingly have rebelled against that. They are very unhappy at his pro-Israel stance. And that was sort of, you know, an unexpected event. And there have been marches, massive marches in America, like what we've seen in London, led by Democratic representatives. And there is a real risk that a good portion of the Democratic vote now will not vote for Biden because of his staunch Israel support. And the Republicans don't have that same problem. And so Biden is a weaker candidate, not just because of his health, the state of the US economy and everything else, but I think the Israel-Gaza dispute has made an already weak candidate very, very vulnerable.
On, you mentioned Israel and Gaza. The hostages are still there, though it seems as though the deal is done. At the time of recording anyway, it looks as though some hostages will be released in exchange for detainees, and they are civilian hostages who were taken hostage from a sovereign country, and in exchange the Israelis will release detainees, and among them people arrested on suspicion of terrorist activities. But things do seem to have de-escalated slightly, don't they? I know that there's still a lot happening on the ground. But has the heat gone out of it in internationally or in terms of the UK compared to a couple of weeks ago?
Probably just at this moment, but we don't know what Iran will do next. It amazes me really that in all of the coverage of what's going on, the words Iran, Iran, Iran are not constantly said. Yeah. They are the real villains behind Hamas, Hezbollah, so much of the destabilisation of the region. I don't think it was an accident that this extraordinary outrage that happened in Israel happened, you know, on the eve of potentially an Abraham Accord between Saudi Arabia and Israel. I think Iran hated what was happening with the Abraham Accords. And if we think that, God, I'm so gloomy, we really need to shut this podcast off now. If we were gloomy about, you know, the world at the moment, wait till Iran has nuclear weapons, which they're on track to do. And that is a very different world, or certainly a very different Middle East, if Iran has nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I was in Bahrain last weekend for the dialogue there, which is the annual event hosted by the IISS, which featured a lot of interesting speeches and sessions. Not a lot of the spirit of the Abraham Accords there, the deal, the famous deal, which is essentially normalisation of relations and pointing towards a different kind of future for the region and economic cooperation. Not that much of that spirit in evidence, but it did. While people were quite gloomy about it, it did seem to me, and it's a really interesting good event that the Bahrainis host. It did seem to me that there's some signs that you can imagine. Once you get a change of government in Israel, which seems bound to come, I know people say don't write off Netanyahu, but it seems pretty clear the government is going to change at some point in the next, well, it could change tomorrow or in a month's time or in 3 months' time. Once you get a different sort of political dispensation, a different kind of coalition, there does seem to be an acceptance that internationally, even among Israel's friends, and Britain can probably be quite influential here as a country, and David Cameron can be quite influential here as a country that has backed in government terms Israel to the hilt since October the 7th, that at that point a new government can start to have a different kind of conversation, because even if you're very pro-Israel, the reality is that after this operation against Hamas, it comes to whatever form of completion it comes to, then there has to be some sort of conversation about what afterwards looks like, because Gaza itself cannot be occupied. Up to 2 million people there. There needs to be some sort of attempt to get peace talks, some sort of settlement going again. Not with Hamas, obviously, for obvious reasons, considering the horrors of what happened on October the 7th. But I came away slightly more optimistic longer term about potential if the British, the Americans, the French, various other people in the region can get their act together with a new Israeli government. There is potential. We'll see. But on that slightly more upbeat...
I wish I'd come with you.
But on that slightly more upbeat note, Tim, just want to thank you for joining us on the Reaction podcast. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. You've been listening to the Reaction podcast. If you're not a subscriber to the site where you get my weekly newsletter and all the great work from the team, go to the website www.reaction.life, sign up and become a subscriber to Reaction. Until next time, thank you for listening.